York. This is Democracy Now!
There is a clear message that is coming through. This is becoming a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
COVID-19 cases have tripled over the past month in the United States as the highly contagious Delta variant rapidly spreads. We'll speak to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ed Yong about why this year may be worse than last for many communities with low vaccination rates. Then we go to Colombia, where demonstrators have filled the streets of cities again to protest the right-wing government of Iván Duque.
I'm very happy with the awakening of the Colombian people, who have finally opened their eyes to the criminality of the police and the neoliberal system that oppresses us more and more every day.
Plus, we get the latest on Haiti 2 weeks after the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. A new prime minister was sworn in Tuesday as questions grow over who orchestrated the killing of the president. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 25 people were killed in China's Henan province as it was battered with a year's worth of rain in 3 days. At least 12 of the victims perished in the inundated subway system. Dramatic online video shows passengers trapped on underground trains, chest high in floodwater. Meteorologists said that kind of rainfall happened, quote, once in a thousand years. Greenpeace has warned China's cities would see even hotter summers and wetter rainy seasons due to the climate crisis. China's evacuated at least 200,000 people. In Siberia, 320,000 residents have been told to stay indoors amidst record-breaking wildfires, with the city of Yakutsk experiencing what might be one of the world's worst ever air pollution events. Here in the United States, the skies are once again thick with haze as far east as here in New York City, as the massive Bootleg and other fires rage in the west. Meanwhile, the Great Salt Lake, the largest salt water lake in the Western Hemisphere, has tied its all-time historic lowest level and is expected to break that record soon amidst the ongoing drought. In Japan, even as some sporting events already started, the head of the Tokyo Olympics Organizing Committee did not rule out a last-minute cancellation of the Olympics as COVID-19 cases continue to rise. Meanwhile, deaf-blind swimmer Becca Myers has withdrawn from the Paralympic Games after being denied the right to be accompanied by her personal care assistant due to new COVID restrictions. Three-time U.S. gold medalist Myers said, quote, in 2021, why as a disabled person am I still fighting for my rights? Thailand enacted a strict nationwide ban on public gatherings as Southeast Asia continues to suffer a devastating COVID surge, with Indonesia recently reporting higher daily case numbers than India and Brazil. Iran has put Tehran and surrounding areas on lockdown ahead of the Eid al-Adha holidays amidst a spike in cases. Meanwhile, France launched its highly contested health pass as officials issued warnings over the current outbreak. This is the French health minister, Olivier Véran.
Yesterday, there were 18,000 new infections in only 24 hours. It means that the spread of the virus has increased by 150% over a week. We have never seen this before.
As coronavirus cases also continue to rise here in the United States, the highly transmissible Delta variant now accounts for over 80% of new infections in the country. COVID-19 deaths also increased by nearly 50% over the past week. Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Mississippi have recorded some of the highest recent surges in cases. This comes as millions of surplus vaccine doses are set to expire and likely go to waste. State health officials have repeatedly asked the federal government to donate the unused doses to other countries experiencing vaccine shortages, but those requests have been rejected. Senators Chris Murphy, Mike Lee, and Bernie Sanders have introduced legislation to curb executive authority when it comes to going to war and massive weapons sales, giving more power to Congress to deliberate and approve such decisions. This is Connecticut Chris Murphy speaking Tuesday.
This shift in national security power to the president has resulted in endless wars, reckless levels of arms sales, and national emergencies that seem to have no termination.
The National Security Powers Act would repeal the 1973 War Powers Act, which presidents have used to circumvent congressional support. It would also repeal existing war authorizations, cut funding for military operations that were not approved by Congress, and require most arms sales to be approved by the House and Senate. In New Jersey, dozens of immigrant justice advocates chained themselves together and blocked the entrance to an Immigration and Customs Enforcement black site in Newark for hours Tuesday morning. Protesters are demanding ICE end the transfer of people to jails in other states. This is one of the activists who joined yesterday's action, Sergio Tupac Uzerin, with NYC ICE Watch.
We need to take direct action against Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They're a rogue agency. They're a fascist agency in the sense that they act totally outside of the law and outside any bounds of morality, taking people, keeping them when they don't have to, refusing to release them, playing games with them, playing games with people's lives. Nine people died of COVID in ICE custody last year. And we're here to shut them down. We'll do whatever it takes, no matter what presidential administration is in office. They have to be completely abolished.
A federal judge has temporarily blocked Arkansas's near-total abortion ban a week before it was set to go into effect, saying it's, quote, categorically unconstitutional. The law makes exceptions only if the pregnant person's life is in danger and disproportionately targets people of color, LGBTQ+, and low-income people. In other reproductive rights news, the Mexican state of Veracruz voted to decriminalize abortion, joining just three other localities that also allow the procedure up to 12 weeks of pregnancy, Mexico City, Oaxaca, and Hidalgo. Veracruz feminist collective La Brujas del Mar, that's the Witches of the Sea, celebrated the news, adding, "Let's go after the 28 states that are left." In Honduras, dozens of Afro-Indigenous Garifuna leaders and supporters took to the streets of the capital, Tegucigalpa, Tuesday, demanding the safe return of four Garifuna land defenders who were abducted from their homes a year ago by men wearing police uniforms. All four men were members of the group Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras. Among them was community leader 27-year-old Albert Snyder Centeno. In other news from Honduras, the U.S. State Department has banned former Honduran right-wing President Porfirio Lobo and his immediate family from traveling to the United States. Lobo is accused of corruption and accepting bribes from drug traffickers. He rose to power in 2009 in a contested election that took place after a U.S.-backed military coup overthrew Honduras's democratically elected government that same year. Lobo was backed by the Obama administration. French President Emmanuel Macron has been identified as a potential surveillance target for Morocco in the major data leak of Israeli company NSO and its Pegasus spyware. 14 world leaders, including South African President Cyril Ramaphosa and the Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, appeared in the list of 50,000 phone numbers that were people of interest for NSO clients since 2016. The world's richest man completed a 10-minute suborbital flight aboard his Blue Origin spacecraft Tuesday. Jeff Bezos spoke at a news conference after his crew landed.
I want to thank every Amazon employee and every Amazon customer, because you guys paid for all of this. So seriously, for every Amazon customer out there and every Amazon employee, thank you from the bottom of my heart very much.
Bezos' remarks drew sharp rebuke. Washington Congressmember Pramila Jayapal tweeted, quote, if Amazon paid its workers fairly and did not fight unionization, workers would not be funding the expensive hobbies of billionaires. They would be taking care of their families and living dignified and fulfilling lives. She also noted that the 11-minute joyride cost over $2.5 million a minute. Yes, it's time to tax the rich, she said. Meanwhile, Democratic Congressmember Earl Blumenauer of Oregon is proposing a tax on commercial space flights that have no scientific value. Space exploration isn't a tax-free holiday for the wealthy, said the Portland congressmember. Others drew attention to the environmental impact of recreational space exploration, with author and former Labor Secretary Robert Reich tweeting that the billionaire's rocket launch emitted 200 to 300 tons of carbon dioxide per rider. Trump advisor and longtime ally Tom Barrack was arrested Tuesday and charged with failing to register as a foreign agent for the United Arab Emirates, conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and making false statements to the FBI. The New York Times reported Barrack's real estate company received some $1.5 billion in investments from the UAE and Saudi Arabia between Trump's 2016 nomination and mid-2019. Barrack was chair of Trump's inauguration committee. Disgraced Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein was extradited from New York to California, where he'll face rape charges in a Los Angeles court. Weinstein, who's already serving a 23-year sentence for four sex crimes in New York, is charged in multiple cases of rape involving actors and models at Los Angeles hotels. South Carolina State University is forgiving the loans of 2,500 former students who had to stop their studies due to financial hardship. The historically black university said it would cancel nearly $10 million of student loans with stimulus money from the CARES Act and American Rescue Plan. Black students are disproportionately hit by the school debt crisis. And a new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association reveals that Americans now have over $140 billion in unpaid medical bills owed to collection agencies. The figure is nearly twice as high as the most recent data from several years ago. But the country's total medical debt is even higher, as the $140 billion does not include bills owed directly to health providers or credit card debt from medical expenses. Republican-run states that chose not to expand Medicaid through the Affordable Care Act had the highest debts. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
In the United States, COVID-19 cases have tripled over the past month as the highly contagious Delta variant rapidly spreads across the country, particularly in areas with low vaccination rates. COVID deaths have increased by nearly 50% over the past week, and cases are rising in all 50 states. The Centers for Disease Control says the Delta variant is now responsible for 83% of COVID-19 cases in the U.S. This is CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky.
There is a clear message that is coming through. This is becoming a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
While the overall COVID numbers are far lower than last winter, public health experts fear the nation's fight against the pandemic is heading in the wrong direction. On Monday, President Biden urged everyone eligible to get vaccinated.
If you're unvaccinated, you are not protected. So please, please get vaccinated. Get vaccinated now. It works. It's safe. It's free. It's convenient.
New federal data released today shows life expectancy in the United States dropped by a year and a half in 2020 due to the pandemic, the largest drop since World War II. Black and Latinx communities saw the largest declines. Meanwhile, COVID cases are also surging across the globe. Indonesia has recorded over 1,000 deaths a day for the past 5 days. In France, the number of new cases has jumped by 150% over the last week. South Korea and Thailand have both reported record numbers of new infections. We're joined now by Ed Yong, science writer at The Atlantic. He recently won the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for his coverage of the pandemic. His most recent piece is titled, Delta is Driving a Wedge Through Missouri. Ed, congratulations on your Pulitzer. This piece is so important as people hail the end of the pandemic. You're diving right into the pandemic right now in one looking at one state, looking at Missouri. Tell us what you found.
So I talked to folks who work in Southwest Missouri, which is really the epicenter of this current surge. And, you know, things are bad. I think things are much worse than people might realize. One of the major hospitals in Springfield acquired as many cases in just 5 weeks as it previously did in 5 months, a testament to how quickly the Delta variant can spread through a community that is largely unvaccinated. In Springfield, Greene County, only 40% of people have been vaccinated, and in many of the surrounding counties, that figure is lower than 20%. This is all causing immense distress for healthcare workers who are once again overwhelmed, once again exhausted. They have been fighting this pandemic for coming on to a year and a half now with barely any breaks. And now they're suffering the moral distress of seeing yet another surge, actually worse than the previous ones, but at a time when vaccines are readily available, when people should be able to very easily protect themselves, and at a time when so much of the U.S. has moved on from the pandemic, as you say. One hospital chief told me, you know, New York has been throwing a ticker tape parade for its healthcare heroes while ours are knee deep in COVID.
And Ed Yong, speaking about the rest of the country moving on, I wanted to refer to there was an NBA, National Basketball Association, championship game last night, Game 6, where the Milwaukee Bucks won the NBA championship. And I want to play a clip of the NBA play-by-play commentator, Jeff Van Gundy, as the camera pans out over more than 65,000 people outside the arena. We're not talking about the people in the arena, but packed into each other outside the arena. This is the clip. I think our producers have it.
Dr. Fauci is cringing at home as he's watching our game.
Very difficult to socially distance outside.
Now, we're talking about Wisconsin, where the positivity rate has gone up in the last 3 weeks from 0.9 to 2.5%, tripled in just the last 3 weeks. And a state that has only 48% of its people fully vaccinated. So we have to assume that maybe about 30,000 of those people outside that arena last night were not vaccinated. What do you think is the responsibility of sports officials or local political leaders with gatherings like this?
I do want to point out that all the evidence we have tells us that being outdoors is a much lower risk than being indoors. Now, obviously, that calculus changes a little bit if you are packed shoulder to shoulder with large groups of people. But I don't think our threat model should be centering like outdoor spaces as like the major source of the major driver of this pandemic. We're talking a lot more about indoor spaces, which are much harder to film. We're talking about places where there's very poor ventilation. And look, you know, we all have a responsibility to try and keep the pandemic under control. Vaccination is obviously our most powerful defense, and it is incumbent upon everyone to try and find ways of getting more people to be vaccinated. But, you know, vaccination is one of many tools at our disposal. There are many others. We've just talked about ventilation, which could be much better across the country. We should talk about things like masking, about distancing where in cases where vaccination rates are low and where the virus is once again taking off. We don't have to put all of our eggs in this one biomedical basket. We do have actually quite a lot of ways of protecting ourselves at our disposal, but we do have to actually use them. And I think the country has had a very poor track record of using them throughout the pandemic, and not just now.
And I wanted to ask you, this week, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommended that all students over the age of 2, as well as teachers and staff, wear masks when they return to school, even if they've been vaccinated. But many states have already banned school mask mandates. What do you think should be the policy on mandating masks?
So I argued in a previous piece that the CDC was premature in lifting its indoor mask mandates and certainly did not do so with enough guidance to allow other bodies, whether it's states or institutions or schools, to make the right decisions. Now, some people argued that the CDC was correct in doing this because it allows for more flexible local level approaches to the pandemic. And while I do understand that argument, I think it doesn't actually hold water because, as you said, one of the consequences of the CDC's move was that a lot of state level leaders put in legislation and mandates of their own that prevented local departments, whether it's schools or public health departments, from giving that more flexible, granular guidance. You know, I think that the pandemic is in a very difficult stage right now. I see what people, where folks who are saying that one size fits all recommendations don't work anymore. I see where that's coming from, but it's hard to actually put that into practice in a situation where you don't know who's been vaccinated, where there's no way of establishing that. And that leaves businesses, it leaves schools, it leaves institutions, it leaves states in the lurch. Like, how do you actually give that more granular, flexible advice when you simply don't know? You know, it either then becomes an honor system, which has huge problems, as we know, or you need to put in broad scale, top down regulations again.
Ed Young, as you look at Missouri, you talk to very tired, dispirited healthcare workers who are suffering PTSD. You speak with one woman who works at a Veterans Affairs hospital in St. Louis, who told you, "I'm a mom of a 1- and a 4-year-old, the daughter of family members in Zimbabwe and South Africa who can't get vaccinated yet," and talks about the frustration and rage she feels that people are not getting vaccinated in Missouri and what this means. And also the number of younger and younger people who are sicker and sicker. They're saying sicker than anyone they saw last year.
Yeah, so there's two tragedies there. Globally, there is massive vaccine inequity. When I last looked at the stats a few weeks ago, only about 10% of the world's population had been fully vaccinated. And in many parts of the world, across the entire continent of Africa, just 1% of people have been. And that's horrifying. You know, we in the United States are living in a situation where vaccine supply far outstrips demand, and people are struggling to find ways of convincing people to get vaccinations. Across much of the world, people are clamoring for vaccines and don't have barely any access to them because countries like the US hoarded vaccines. And, you know, we are now, with Delta ripping through the world, I don't think we have a lot of time to vaccinate the rest of the world. You know, this is a matter of intense moral urgency, and I'm not sure rich countries are acting as if that's the case. You know, the other thing that you mentioned is that there seem to be signs that Delta is having worse effects on younger people. In Missouri, younger folks are making up a higher proportion of the people who are hospitalized than they were last year. Now, in partly, that's just because elderly people were more likely to be vaccinated. And so, obviously, the age range of people going to hospital now with COVID is going to shift downward. That's expected. But I asked everyone, every doctor and nurse who I spoke to in Missouri, compare a 30-year-old who has COVID now. Are they sicker than a 30-year-old who you saw this time last year? And unanimously, they said yes. There are many possible reasons for that. But I think the upshot is Delta is making younger people sicker than they were last year. And that is a problem. Like, we think of the pandemic as a thing that only affects the elderly. A lot of young people think they're invincible. That wasn't the case last year. It very much is not the case now.
And today we're concerned primarily about the Delta variant. But what about future variants? What concerns you the most?
My concern is that as the virus continues to spread around the world, both in largely unvaccinated countries, as we've said, or in unvaccinated pockets within the US, every new person it infects, the more widely it spreads, it just gets more chances to evolve into even worse variants that might be even more transmissible, or that might finally break through the immune defenses that our current vaccines provide. Either of these outcomes would be terrible. In even transmissibility, Delta is showing us what a more transmissible variant can do. The more we let this pandemic linger on, rage on around the world, the less protected any of us will be, including those of us who currently luxuriate under the umbrella of vaccination. You know, it is incumbent upon everyone, including those of us who've been vaccinated, to try and push for an end to the pandemic rather than assume that we are going to be safe forevermore.
And as you see this shift in places like Missouri and throughout the South of vast swaths of unvaccinated of the country with unvaccinated people, what do you think the answer is?
The answer is hard. We're reaching a point where a lot of people, I think, have made up their minds about vaccines or have very entrenched beliefs and disbeliefs. I think a lot of folks are feeling very frustrated about shifting the needle. But I think the needle can be shifted. I think that a lot of this has to do with establishing trust, going out to communities, listening to their concerns, thinking about what their concerns are, addressing them, and, you know, to build those very human connections that we've all relied upon over the last year and year plus. You know, it is, I think it is very wrong to believe that the unvaccinated, quote unquote, are this monolith of people who are antagonistic and just being difficult. A lot of them have still very legitimate questions. And, you know, people I've talked to, even in Southwest Missouri, have had a lot of success trying to use trusted community voices, whether it's firefighters or pastors or just people's neighbors going around door to door. You know, when the vaccination campaign started, it was very much, we're going to open a place and you come to us. And we got the most eager people vaccinated. And now it's harder. It's a harder high-touch game where we're going to have to go out to communities. We're going to have to establish trust. And that work, unfortunately, is slow. It is slow, and Delta is very, very fast. So, again, it is incumbent upon everyone else to try and buy as much time for that work to take place as possible, because the cost of it not happening isn't just going to befall the unvaccinated communities. It's also going to affect the rest of us in the long run.
And, Ed Young, as a journalist, how do you react to those who are seeking to get the social media companies to be held responsible for some of the posts on their social media platforms that are either anti-vaxxer or spreading misinformation about the vaccines?
Yeah, I think that it is very clear that misinformation circulates faster on social media platforms than accurate information. We have evidence to show that that is the case. And I think unless social media companies take more accountability of the power of their platforms, and unless they take further steps to improve matters, we're always going to be on a back foot. You know, I said that building trust is slow, that we're going to have to reach out to individuals and turn, you know, everyone into an influencer within their own communities. That work is going to be harder and slower if disinformation, if misinformation is allowed to cascade through social media channels to the same extent that it has been already.
We want to thank you so much, Ed Yong, for being with us. Science writer at The Atlantic, recently won the Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the pandemic. We'll link to your piece, Delta is driving a wedge through Missouri. Next up, we go south to Colombia, where demonstrators have filled the streets again to protest the right-wing government of Iván Duque. Stay with us.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just upped my rent last night because Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon. I wonder why he's upping me because Whitey's on the moon. Well, I was already giving him 50 a week, and now Whitey's on the moon. Taxes taking my whole damn check. The junkies make me a nervous wreck. The price of food is going up. And as if all that crap wasn't enough, a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. Was all that money I made last year for Whitey on the moon? How come I ain't got no money here? Whitey's on the moon.
Whitey on the Moon by Gil Scott Heron. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn now to Colombia, where anti-government protesters filled the streets of a number of cities Tuesday on Colombia's Independence Day, the same day right-wing President Iván Duque presented a new tax reform bill to Congress. The last tax proposal failed in April after it prompted a general strike and massive demonstrations that also focused on deepening economic disparity and human rights abuses. Tuesday's demonstrations came even after some of the organizers were arrested and harassed over the weekend. The country's defense minister had claimed violence was expected at the protests and put Bogota and 10 of Colombia's 32 provincial capitals on heightened alert. The protests were called in part by Colombia's National Strike Committee that includes indigenous people, students, and trade unions. This is Francisco Maltes, president of the Colombian Central Union of Workers, speaking during Bogota demonstration.
Today, we presented a 10-point platform that highlights the most urgent needs. The Colombian Congress historically begins its first session every July 20th at 2 in the afternoon. Anyone who wants to be present at this session is generally allowed to. Today, when there was a massive social demonstration, the government rushed the start of the session to 8 in the morning and denied entry to the press and others. This reflects the anti-democratic character of President Duque's government.
For more, we go to Colombia. In Cali, activist Maria del Rosario Arango is with us. She was at Tuesday's protests. And in Bogota, we're joined by award-winning journalist Mario Murillo, who was at the protests in Bogota. He's closely followed Colombia for decades. His books include Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Mario, let's begin with you in Bogota. Talk about the demands of the protests. These have been going on for some 84 days now.
Thank you, Amy, for having us. The protest yesterday was essentially a continuation of the national strike, which, as you pointed out, began on April 28th. These mobilizations that were very, very well covered and you reported on recently also were continuing in a different dimension, but yesterday they were re-sparked, considering that it was, of course, Independence Day here in Colombia. And it took place in various cities. I was here in Bogota. At least 10,000 people were in the march that started early afternoon in downtown Bogota, and generally peaceful. But there were also protests all around the country, in Barranquilla, in Cali, where Maria is joining us as well. And it was amazing that it took place, notwithstanding the fear tactics that were being used by the government leading up to the July 20th mobilizations, because they were talking about infiltrations of the ELN in some of the cities. They highly militarized all of the country with 65,000 public security forces, not only police, but also armed forces and the ESMAT, the special forces unit that has been criticized viscerally for their violence that carried out in the recent mobilizations earlier in the protests. So it went on, and last night, really in the evening, we started hearing reports all around the country of those confrontations, which I think Maria could talk more directly to, specifically in Cali, where for the past 3 months now, the confrontations have been strongest against civilians in these protests.
And Maria del Rosario Arango, I wanted to ask you, talk to us about the protests in Cali, and why have the people risen up so strongly now against the President Iván Duque?
Thank you. Yes, I'm saying hello from Cali, which is the largest city, the third largest city in Colombia, the second city of Latin America with more African descendant population and with a large history of social movements like unions, indigenous peoples, student movements, and now like this movement that have been called like frontliners, which are jobs that are facing the police abuse. So this had been like the capital of the resistance in Cali. It is called now that way, but it also has been like the center of the more abusive repression of the police, but not only the police, like the security forces that have been repressing the protesters here in Colombia. It has been shown yesterday too.
And Maria, can you talk more about what's happening in Cali, why it is such a center of protest, and also talk about the issue of violence against women in the LGBTQ plus community?
Yes, thank you. So as I told you, like Cali have this long history of resistance that have been shown now, but also the repression has been especially brutal here, not only by security forces, but also by paramilitary groups. So when the strike started on the 28th of April, the resistance have been strong here and the repression too. These have been like several patterns of violence against protesters, against demonstrators, which has been like police have been using fire guns against protesters. Like, if you go to protest, you're risking to die. They have also used other strategic to repress, like spreading terror, and this includes, like, sexual assaults. For example, before yesterday, during the protest in April, May, and June, we have been recording 28 cases of sexual assault by the police. So this is not only like this policial repression, just killing people, but also gathering and targeting women's LGBT population, but also profiling, threatening, and persecuting all the people that are leaving the protest, but also all those who are showing solidarity with the protesters. I mean, in this month in Cali, we have seen how police have attacked with fire guns and firearms, for example, the medical assistants who are being giving this healthcare to the protesters. The people of the community that are doing like this act of solidarity to feed the protesters. In one word, we can say that solidarity is being criminalized.
And Mario, I wanted to ask you, on Monday, President Duque announced reforms to the policing in the country. Do you think this is going to what were those reforms? And do you think this is going to have any impact on the resistance and the strike movement?
I think the basis of the reforms are very superficial. One of the points is changing their uniform, because there's been a lot of criticism, and one of the demands has been to take the police, the national police, out of the and away from the defense ministry and put it into the interior ministry, make it more civilian oriented. The police have been trained to treat civilians as essentially internal enemies. This is the mindset of years of internal war and conflict with the armed, with the guerrilla groups. So there's this mentality that has always plagued the national police to confront any kind of civilian opposition or mobilization, or even street, kids, young folks living in the streets and very marginalized communities, as enemies, as garbage. And in many ways, the response to the police abuse of the last few months is that rage that's inside, especially young people who are sick and tired of being treated as animals, as non-human, as enemies internally. So the idea of changing the uniform to blue and making them look really nice as to show that they're no longer part of the military doesn't take them out of the defense ministry. It's still within that frame. In fact, yesterday, the press conferences in the evening, you had the defense minister speaking about the protests that were getting supposedly violent last night in different parts of the country. So that's one thing. The other thing is putting body cams, right? That kind of, again, that superficial approach to police violence and security. The bottom line is that the years of internal war has created this mindset within the public security forces, and it goes from the National Army, the armed forces, all the way down to your local CAI, which is like the local police patrolling local neighborhoods, see the civilian population as enemies, and in many ways it is destructive. And this is what among the many points of the protests that have been going on over the last several months. And it's not only about police reform, it's also about economic reform and recognizing the needs of many of these same young people who are out in the streets, who have no job opportunities given the current economic climate, who have no opportunities for education. So the 10-point political program that's being put forward by the National Strike Committee, and that's essentially bringing the protests from the streets to a political level, is issues around living wages for working people, about a state-sponsored healthcare system, which has been clearly shown to be inadequate given the levels of COVID that we've seen, the public hospital system completely broken. Yesterday, I think the report was 380 people died of COVID yesterday. In other words, every day here in Colombia for the last several months, we've been seeing up to between 300 and 500 people dying of COVID. No healthcare system. They're talking about a free education system for young folks who have no opportunities to go to school. And of course, the dismantling of the ESMAD, the national, rapid deployment police force that was the creation of Plan Colombia back in 1999, essentially to combat drug traffickers, are now being used and have been used for the last 15 years against civilians protesting against the government. So there's a lot of reforms being pushed forward. And unfortunately, the Colombian government continues to give it lip service. And as they did yesterday, talking about police reform, a new tax reform law, which essentially is kind of putting a Band-Aid on, a severed hand, if you will.
Mario, before I ask you about the Colombian mercenaries that were involved with the assassination of the Haitian president, very quickly, you're in Colombia following the Colombian Human Rights Commission. Can you talk about the latest results they have found in Colombia?
Right. The International Commission of Verification was invited here by a coalition of Colombian human rights groups, a range of groups that have been very concerned about the last few months of protests and how impunity, which is a consistent pattern here in Colombia, was basically getting into effect given the dozens of complaints, the hundreds of complaints and denunciations of human rights violations that were taking place during the first stages of the protests. So the commission came here to Bogota 43 members of the commission from around the world, from Europe, from Latin America, from Canada, from the United States, from other parts of the world, to essentially visit different areas of the country. So, you know, for example, I went to the coffee-growing region. Maria was in Cali and interviewed collectively, we interviewed about 180 different victims who had unbelievable testimonies about how they were dealt with during the course of the protests starting on April 28th. And we saw, as was talked about before, the victims of sexual violence who talked to us about the abuse that they received, the hundreds of people who were wounded and many who were detained without any explanation and disappeared for days on end. The reports are anywhere between 75 to 80 people killed, including 44 specifically attributed to the National Security Forces. And so we were documenting that to draw attention to this problem, which continues to get handled in the Colombian media and by the Colombian government in a very kind of double speak way. It's like as if they're living in a different world. We met even with public officials. We met with police. We met with governors and local human rights government human rights workers who were supposedly there to defend the people. And their answer is always the same thing. You know how many police were wounded? Do you know how much public property was damaged? Essentially ignoring the demands. And in many cases saying, well, we're not hearing denunciations. We're not getting public denunciations from these so-called victims. And the argument is that once again, they're forgetting and they're denying the many, many years of repression against anybody who speaks out against people who are, you know, against the state, against the government. And that's what has been going on. And that's what some of the things that we found in the commission.
Maria, I also wanted to ask you about the role of the Colombian mercenaries in the assassination 2 weeks ago of the Haitian president, Jovenel Moïse. The Washington Post has reported some of the Colombians had received U.S. military training while they were part of the Colombian armed services. One of the mercenaries has been identified as former Special Commando Grosso Guarín. Reporter Dan Cohen has written that Grosso was once assigned to Colombia's Urban Anti-Terrorist Special Force Group, a secretive elite military detachment dedicated to supposedly counterterrorism operations and carrying out kidnappings and assassinations. Another one of Colombian mercenaries that was arrested in Haiti was Francisco Eladio Uribe Ochoa, who was once investigated for his role in executing civilians in Colombia, then disguising them as combatants, a practice known as false positive. A practice they were dressed then as dressed up as FARC. The Colombian military has been accused of killing over 6,400 civilians in this way. Cohen writes, quote, this gruesome practice helped military commanders reach lofty kill count quotas set by the U.S. and was incentivized with bonus pay and vacation time for soldiers who carried out the killings. Now, again, two of these men, Colombian mercenaries, arrested in Haiti. And, of course, the number of Colombian mercenaries involved in the assassination, it's believed to be more than 20. Can you comment on this?
Yeah, the specifics and the role that the Colombian mercenaries played in the assassination is still unclear. There's a lot of muddied reports as the investigation begins to unfold in Haiti and here in Colombia, reports trickling out. Essentially, what this is an example of what one retired sergeant who's spent 20 years in counterterrorism, counter-narcotics work here in Colombia, he was interviewed in El Espectador on Sunday. Interesting interview, which was mind-boggling to hear the details of that. What he referred to as the producto de exportación con alta solicitud, an export product in high demand, which is essentially those thousands of Colombian soldiers, officers, et cetera, who over the last 20 years, specifically after Plan Colombia was implemented and Plan Patriota, which was Uribe's continuation of Plan Colombia, a hyper-militarization of the country, a doubling of the size of the military, and essentially trained and built on these counter-terrorism, counter-narcotics operations, the kind of the high-value target, extraction types of tactics. That is, you know, we're talking about thousands of soldiers who've been going around the world to the United Arab Emirates, to Afghanistan, to Iraq. These are highly trained, highly disciplined soldiers of war. You know, they're artists of war, and they're being used around the country. You know, like Cuba uses, sends medical practitioners, doctors around the world. Colombia is sending these soldiers who actually talk about how they very often don't have enough after retiring in their pensions to support their families. So they have these highly lucrative contracts for 2 or 3 years and go all over the world and carry out similar operations.
Well,
so this is essentially a reflection of that export product that is coming out of Colombia.
Well, Mario, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Mario Murillo, award-winning journalist who's followed Colombia for decades. His books include Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization. Maria del Rosario Arango, thank you for joining us from Cali. As we turn now to Haiti, we will speak with a Haitian pro-democracy advocate about the latest developments in Haiti 2 weeks after the assassination of the president. Stay with us. FX Twin. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Dr. Ariel Henry has become Haiti's new prime minister. He was sworn into office Tuesday, a day after the acting prime minister, Claude Joseph, announced he was relinquishing power. Henry, who's a neurosurgeon, was appointed by President Jovenel Moïse shortly before he was assassinated on July 7th. Both Joseph and Henry had claimed power following Moïse's death. Over the weekend, the United States and other members of the so-called core group threw its support behind Dr. Henry, who will become Haiti's seventh prime minister in 4 years. Claude Joseph will stay in the new government as foreign minister. On Monday, State Department spokesperson Ned Price defended the Biden administration's decision to back Henry. He was questioned by the Associated Press's Matt Lee.
We are taking the side of the Haitian people. We're taking the side
of the guy who was named but hadn't taken office.
We are taking the side of the Haitian people. This is a dialogue that has been ongoing between various Haitian political stakeholders.
Yeah, whether you want to admit it or not, there was a shift in what you had been saying prior to that statement. You were all in support of the acting prime minister. And then all of a sudden on Saturday, you and the other members of the core group came out in support of Mr. Henry.
Matt, we are supporting the inclusive dialogue that Haiti's political actors are undertaking themselves.
We're joined now by Monique Kleska, a Haitian pro-democracy advocate usually based in Port-au-Prince. She worked for many years with the UN, including at UNICEF in Haiti for 15 years. She's joining us now from Washington, D.C., where she's just arrived from Port-au-Prince. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Monique. As you listen to this discussion in the United States about who will be the prime minister, who is the prime minister of Haiti after the assassination of the Haitian president, what are your thoughts and what are you calling for?
Well, thank you. I'm very honored to be invited to Democracy Now! My thoughts in hearing Ned Price is they haven't talked to us. They haven't. How can what such arrogance of a State Department spokesman to say they are speaking on behalf of the Haitian people? No, I believe the Haitian people are able to speak for themselves. And we have been speaking for ourselves for the last 3 years during this crisis, demonstration after demonstration. How many demonstrators have been killed? No one listened to what we're saying. And now what we've been saying is, let us pause. Let us sit down and Haitians talk together come together and find a solution. It's not going to be like magic that it's going to be done. There is such polarization. There is such mistrust. But we must do this. It is not up to the United States State Department to tell us who should be the prime minister of Haiti. It is offensive. It should not be done. It is unacceptable. That is my reaction to this. And the Haitian people will not accept it. We will protest. We will fight, and we will continue to bear, to continue the fight to get a democracy, but not a democracy a la Jovenel, as Mr. Moïse had said, before his unfortunate, brutal, and untimely death. No, we will do it the way Haitians want to do it, properly and in a democratic way.
Monique Glasgow, I wanted to ask you, why, in your sense, what is your sense of why Claude Joseph agreed to hand over power to Mr. Henry, to Ariel Henry? Because it seems almost like who is less illegitimate, because they were both got their power from the assassinated leader, who was himself questions about his ability to hold power after his term ended.
They are all illegitimate. Jovenel Moïse was illegitimate. He held power in a very autocratic way. He was a dictator. He should have left back in February. The Prime Minister Claude Joseph was illegitimate because he came from Jovenel Moïse. It's the same regime. Ariel Henry is illegitimate. They are all illegitimate. And that's what we're saying. Why did Ariel Henry decide to step aside? I have no idea. I have no idea who whispered anything in his ear. All we know is that before Jovenel Moïse's corpse was even cold, they were saying, the U.S. and the U.N. were saying, it should be Claude Joseph. Then a few days later, they change and say, it should be Ariel Henry. Whatever is being cooked on the back burner somewhere in the U.S. Embassy, the U.S. State Department, or the UN Binu office of Madame Lalim, really has nothing to do with the Haitian people. We actually, at the commission that I'm honored to be part of, had several meetings where various groups of civil society came to discuss a draft agreement. And they agreed that the Constitution 1987 should be respected. They agreed that there should be a provisional president and a prime minister, and are about to set up a committee so that they can decide and propose names to be provisional president and provisional prime minister. And it has come from an elaborate, consensual process over the last 4 months with political parties and civil society. That is what we are saying. It is up to the Haitian people. And we cannot continue this way to have our sovereignty just stepped upon, not only by the United States government, but also by the UN, and also by the likes of Ariel Henry and Claude Joseph, who await instructions from the State Department and from the U.S. Embassy, rather than listen to us Haitian people. And this is what we're saying. Listen to our voices. That's what democracy is about. It's not taking something from the State Department, from a very arrogant spokesperson at the State Department who is saying, we're listening to the Haitian people. This is funny. The American embassy has not even called a commission. Not once have they called us to say, we would like to hear what you're saying. Yep. No, this is unacceptable.
Monique Lesko, we want to thank you for being with us. Of course, we're going to continue to follow this and also who murdered the Haitian president. Monique Lesko is a Haitian pro-democracy advocate who's just come up to Washington, usually in Port-au-Prince. She's a member of the Commission for a Haitian Solution to the Crisis. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our video production fellowship and our digital fellowship here at our New York City studio. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tommy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Adriana Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.